This is the 11th temple lecture in the second teaching cycle on the human soul. I like to talk about what I generally call a psychic trial and growth. We have understood the soul, the human soul, as a concatenation of eons of growth, like the body that reflects in its structure earlier and more primitive and simpler forms. It is a great holon of other holons that themselves are holons of smaller holons and so on. It's a great structure. It can be considered to be like a building or like something that has been built. And human souls differ, as I said before. The Taj Mahal is a building, and so is an outhouse a building, but there's tremendous differences in what is contained and what has gone into the building of them. If we were to visualize the human soul as kind of a small sphere about this size, and then in order for the sake of the visualization, to visualize the divine soul of God, so to speak, the Shekinah of God, the Parusha of God, as an infinitely large sphere, then as the human soul grows and expands, it grows Godward, it grows towards filling out that volume, but of course can never do that because it is part of that volume, it is part of that that great infinite sphere. And so the growth of the human soul is an expansion that comes into a greater comprehension and a greater expansion of awareness and comprehensivity. But this growth is limited. The human soul is such a great, great concatenation of other psychic levels, or of other souls, we might say. We've called it a we rather than an I, because it is a great city or a great planet of many, many, many origins and kinds of life that reflect the adventure of the monad through the mineral kingdom and the vegetable kingdom and the animal kingdom and so on. That it reaches a point of greatest expansion, and yet it reaches a point of great instability. If we were to take blocks, children's blocks, and pile them one upon the other and one upon the other, we'd finally come to a point where if we added one more block, the whole structure would fall. The human soul, in a sense, can be like that. The human soul is able to inhere and to hold together in as an integral unit only if the unity of that soul and the integrity of that soul is carefully worked out. The human being, the demarcation between the human and the superhuman, is like a great change of phase. If we look at something like the heating of water, we can heat water 1 degree centigrade by adding 1 calorie of heat to each cubic gram of water, and we can raise it from 1 degree to 100 degrees. But we cannot raise it from 100 degrees to 101 degrees unless we add 540 calories because of heat, which is 540 times the energy that it takes to make the phase change from water into steam, from the liquid into the gaseous phase. And that phase change is a kind of ceiling or a level that human beings are constantly butting up against, and this is the very source of human trial. This is the source of human spiritual trial and perplexity, is the fact that we can't get beyond a certain kind of ceiling. At least we have the feeling that we can. Indeed we can, but the kind, just as in the normal growth of the human soul, we can make many, many advancements, degree upon degree, many attainments, many accumulations, but the time comes when we finally hit this place that if we try to go beyond it, we either threaten the whole structure of the human soul and the whole integrity of it, or else we simply have come to a dead end, it seems, that we've come to a brick wall. And in order to get past that, it takes a tremendous amount more energy than an individual human being can generate. It takes the power of initiation. And initiation is something we do ourselves, but we do it in conjunction with the greater we that we are part of. In order to become more expanded at that point, it is necessary to stop seeing oneself as an I and to start seeing oneself as part of a greater I or part of a greater we. And that greater we call hierarchy. We call it the spiritual brotherhood and sisterhood, the ashrams of the elders of humanity, however we call it. At that point, we need some higher kind of energy. Now, for normal daily life and normal daily living, the vital energy is restored to the body through a night of sleep. And it is also true with the spiritual energy and the pathotic energy and the other kinds of forms of force that come into the human soul, because the human soul is like a great beehive that things are constantly passing into and out of. But there comes a time when we reach a certain point that sleep no longer brings us enough force to continue to progress, because we also gain spiritual force. We gain instruction, we gain other kinds of spiritual forces during sleep. And we therefore have to begin a special kind of meditation, not simply a meditation that is designed to help focus the mind or to do other kinds of things, but a meditation that is designed specifically to fill our chalice with higher energies and nectars. The Eucharist, the liturgy of the chalice, is one absolutely necessary thing. It is one way that this higher energy is brought into us in order to bring us to that phase change. And the other way is through meditation and through acts of service and through feelings of joy and bliss and gratitude and other kinds of higher sensibilities and through the accumulations that we make that I'll talk about in a moment. Now, the soul then has accumulations. They are not necessarily memories. In fact, the memories that people have of previous lives are not true memories as we have memories. They are dreams or visions that are triggered by something more essential. And so they're not really accurate. They're not accurate in the sense that a movie of some part of somebody's life would be accurate. They're rather clues that get magnified in a certain way and then get fleshed out and clothed and seen in a visionary way. But when one looks at one's previous lifetimes, one isn't seeing them through memory. One is seeing them through another kind of connection which enlivens the current memory and imagination and brings through these visions. And what we accumulate that we take with us from incarnation to incarnation is not memory, and it is not certain kinds of talents that are based on memory. As I said, if you're a great mathematician in one incarnation, doesn't mean you'll be a great mathematician in another. The thing that helped you to become a great mathematician may be the thing that will help you to become a great musician. But are these people... We continue with the lecture concerning the human soul. The things that we accumulate in our soul are not memories and the things that we carry with us from lifetime to lifetime, nor are they things that we call talents. But we might liken them to two basic kinds of things that are either positive things or negative things. These accumulations are either evolutions or involutions, nectars or bitternesses, harmonies or dissonances, expanders or contractors. And they can be accumulated only through experience in flesh, incarnate experience. And this happens either through reaction to experience, which is the way that most simpler humanity and less evolved humanity experiences things, by reaction. even criminal behavior and all kinds of things are reactions to things, psychological reactions. And this is lower triadic or animal, human type of accumulations. Or by conscious creation of experience, which is higher triadic and intentional use of will. It's thelemic experience. The first category is the whole subject of exoteric religion and all religions. How one carries oneself in life and Buddhist wisdom and Christian wisdom and so on. You cannot do the second category of accumulations without mastery of the first category. And the first category is subject to what have been known as karmic laws. But in the second category, the thelemic category, the category of conscious creation of experience, karma is subject to divine thelemic laws, the best known of which is the law of forgiveness. And these higher laws have been taught in other religions but not understood well. Now, therefore, the disciple needs to be engaged in conscious soul building. As I gave the example of the water, it can be raised 1 degree centigrade by 1 calorie of heat for each gram of water until it reaches the ceiling, this 100 degrees centigrade, and then it takes 540 calories just to move it up the next degree. And that is what initiation accomplishes, and that is that kind of force is no longer the force of the individual or the egoic being as we know ourselves in lower consciousness is able to bring for oneself. That takes higher force, it takes higher energy, and working with a higher we, with a higher unity of being than simply working on one's own self. And that is the force that comes through sleep, the higher forces that come through sleep, and the higher instruction, and all this is not enough to raise a person into that change. And what is necessary at this point is a tremendous personal effort and also a tremendous group effort in making oneself pure in order to join with the group for that effort. Conscious soul building is tantric. It involves involuting involutions, inverting inversions to make them evolutionary. That is turning negatives and weaknesses, what are perceived as negatives, weaknesses, and disharmonies, into positives and strengths and harmonies. It is to render all the accumulations that one has in the soul valid and fill the soul with integrity and harmony, because the soul is full of disharmonies and cracks and disjunctures that, because of the complexity of the human soul, as I said, like a stack of blocks, if you add a few more blocks, it won't support it. There has to be something that holds that together, some way of structuring that in order to expand. And it becomes a house built on rock rather than sand when one begins to consciously deal with this sort of thing. Now, the other thing besides these more tantric techniques are intentionally adding accumulations, positive accumulations, evolutions, nectar, strengths, and harmonies from this point onward. And so if we look now at the first of these, inverting the inversions, that is taking the weaknesses and turning them into strengths, one has to have an analysis of what the weaknesses in one's own soul are. And believe me, it's very difficult to do for oneself. And it's difficult to believe for other people. The technique that works the best, from what my own experience is, if one can imagine one's worst enemy, what one's worst enemy would say in a radical critique of oneself, and then imagine what one's dearest friend would say about the very same things, and look at these two, one is able to get to kind of by triangulation to come to a point of understanding what the characteristic is that would create both of these manifestations. Let me give you an example. Let's say there's a woman who is a president of a bank, and she has many male employees. And let us say that we ask one of her employees what she like, and he says she is a ball-crashing bitch, and she is mean, and she is she pushes people around, and she blah 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 blah. Then we ask her best friend what she says. She says she's strong. She has a strong individuality. She's very thorough. She cares about the work she does, and she wants it to be done right, and she blah blah blah. Both of those viewpoints reflect a certain thing in that woman that's perceived differently. And all perception is plastic. No individual's perception is right, where it's all relative. And so by doing this for yourself and looking at how you or your worst enemy could analyze you, and then your best friend could analyze you, you can start to find these points that are the intersection points for strong weaknesses and strengths that are related, that are just different aspects of the same thing. Basically, there are six kinds of weakness in the soul, and they do not relate directly to social and human ideas of moral things and character defects and things like that. These are all secondary to this. Basically, one kind of weakness that one has in one's soul is basically, we can see the soul as having a basic component of what we might call three rays. And in some systems, this is called the ray of will, the ray of love, wisdom, and the ray of intellect. And there is a lot of truth to this analysis, a very good analysis, but there are six kinds of weaknesses that come in the integrity of the soul that interfere with its expansion up when it achieves a certain point. The first one is simply weakness of will. Now, weakness of will can result from non-challenge through self-indulgence, or it can come through monastic or non-challenging life. People who have been through monastic life, it comes through people who have had lives as royalty, and they've been pampered, and they haven't been challenged in different kinds of ways. These kinds of weaknesses will come. Now, all people have this, and each of us have these in different aspects. In certain lives, in certain lifetimes, will produce these weaknesses. Then there is what I call the sacrificed will. There are some people who become so deeply involved, so sacrificially involved in life, that their whole discipline is to give up their will and to do what is best for other people. I always take the smallest piece of pie on the plate, and I always do this, and I always do this sort of thing. And the positive thing about that is that that is a practice that has certain positive things, but it has a negative fallout. And that when you ask a person like this who has been sacrificial all this person's lifetime, what do you want? What do you want? What do I want? You know, I don't know what I want. They haven't thought that way. Yeah, whatever is wanted for me, you know. And this is a weakness. This is a weakness in will. This is what I call sacrificed will. Now, and this can lead to very serious psychic problems, such as vulnerability to other strong wills, mediumship, which is a spiritual weakness, not a strength, vulnerability to obsessive forces, to possessive forces, susceptibility to control, to suggestion, and to illusion. And people who become excessively religious in the Catholic sense, or some of those kinds of devotional religions, very often end up with this kind of weakness built into their psychic structure when they've made many accumulations, but they're not held together properly, and that can fall. Now, there is also, this is all through failure to develop what we call the first ray, which is called will. And it's very important, not self-will, but divine will, and divine will manifesting in this flesh is very different. People's idea of willfulness. Will means fidelity, perseverance, ability to stick to something, ability to keep at something when everyone else is falling apart. Will does not mean to be selfish. Will means that you hang on by your teeth. Right. You work a conviction. Right. Now, then there is a failure to develop second ray type qualities. That is, that these get developed out in certain ways. And these are either through warped connections to other people, other souls, or warped connections to one's own soul. And these warped connections happen, we talk about it as a frozen heart, the Ebenezer Scrooge syndrome or something like that. But failure to develop this results in feeling a separation, called separationism, a separation between you and other people that is enhanced by lying, dishonesty, never being completely direct, always holding something back, withholding secrecy, and even criminality, or a kind of warped connection to one's own soul, which results in an insensitivity and a perceived insensitivity and selfishness and contracted focus on the self. One doesn't see that in oneself at all. One doesn't see oneself as selfish. One sees oneself as focused and concentrated. But other people would see such a person as completely oblivious to what's going on around him and not noticing his brother's dying. Hey, what's going on here? You know, this sort of thing. This warped connection to one's own soul is a warped connection to one's own higher sensibilities and feelings. And failure to develop third ray intelligence doesn't necessarily mean one is not good in school or anything like that. I mean, there can be very unintelligent people who are very, very good at academics and very intelligent people who aren't. But it results in a warped understanding of other souls and a warped understanding of oneself. If one doesn't have an understanding, is not able to meet and make an understanding of other beings, and other beings don't just include other human beings, but other divine beings and the Godhead itself. A warped understanding tends to bring out judgmentalism in a person, paranoia, inability to be fair, and cruelty, which has been called by some of the philosophers a blood sin. That is the sin of all sins, cruelty. Or a warped understanding of self, which are psychological problems, guilt, crystallized habits, opinions, or kind of rutted brain that one just goes on and on with, inability to change or deal with change positively, and development of extremist, very narrow and extremist views, conservative or radical views. These are six types of weaknesses that occur, and out of them come what people perceive as character flaws and character defects, or so-and-so's an asshole, or this kind of stuff. We all have different chemistry. This person and this person might have good chemistry, and they just think the world of each other. Another person comes along, and he doesn't have the same chemistry. That is ray chemistry, ray type. And this guy's an asshole. This guy's an asshole. They can't stand to be in the same room. As people become more expanded, you can tolerate more and more of those differences. And finally, you can enjoy anybody. But I don't know if it happens perfectly, but it happens better than, you know. I can't. So a weak will or a sacrificed will, a warped connectivity to other beings, and a warped connectivity one's own interior, and a warped understanding, and not a good, clear understanding of what's going on with other people, and not a way of interpreting them or understanding them well, and a warped understanding to oneself. And if one can analyze in oneself what of those things are operating, what's operating here, then one can undertake some kind of corrective spiritual judo that can deal with these things. Let's say, for example, that I become aware of the fact that I have, I remember when I was in my very early 20s and I was a postulant for Holy Orders in the Episcopal Church, and I went to confession on every Friday, and I kept a little notebook of my things that I wanted to get rid of in myself, that I didn't like about myself, that I started to find out about myself. I had a temper, for example, and things like that. As I became aware of them, I got control over them. All I had to do was start looking for them. Now, these are the simple things. But there's a great, great technique for dealing with that people like Krishnamurti have advocated, which is simply said, don't judge yourself. Just put yourself into look at yourself from a point of view that is not subjective. Just look at yourself objectively. Don't judge yourself as you're doing things. Just watch yourself do things. And don't judge yourself about it. Just watch yourself doing them and let yourself go through your numbers. Don't try to hold it back. Just let yourself go through it and let yourself think the thoughts that you want to think and behave the ways and say the things and look at it. Enough for you to get it out so you can see what it is. And then you can just the process of seeing it very often starts the process of a correctiveness, of sealing up those cracks in your soul. And then there are some things that you really want to completely release from yourself, things that are in you that you don't want in you, that you want out, like a weed out of a garden. And in order to get those things, there has to be enough of the weed out that you can grab it to get enough of a hold to pull out by the roots, because if you don't get it out by the roots... Now, in our normal consciousness, now we're not able to see or recognize psychic flaws. We can see flaws that other people see in us. We can be aware that someone thinks that we're too this or too that, or we can get paranoid about this or that, or we can see things. But usually, the person who's especially, who really has a virtue of humility, is the person who will see himself as being too forward and too egotistical. And the person who has the virtue of honesty, real honesty, is the person who will see himself as he'll see his own little dishonest parts and magnify them. So very often what you see is your flaws are very often your virtues. And so what you see, you never question as being a virtue. What you never question as being a virtue is very often where the trick is. That's where the thing is. The great Sir Francis Bacon, who was a master in his lifetime, took the rap for King James in order to keep him from the fundamentalists coming in. They finally did 20 years later when Cromwell came in and beheaded the king and took over. But Bacon took the rap for that so that the important work that was going on, which was the colonizing of the New World and some other kinds of things that he wrote very incredible things about, the New World, the New Humanity, he wrote about these things. He took the rap for that and ended his life in infamy and was studied by British schoolboys as being an embezzler, an old embezzler, until 100 years ago the Baconian Foundation started discovering who this man really was. And you'll find many great masters have been perceived as criminals and have died in infamy or have been socially perceived in that way. I happen to have a photograph in my pocket over here. I'll show you later, of the room in which Socrates stayed when he was imprisoned for corrupting the youth, and where he finally took the hemlock. Well, it's still there. It's a national shrine now. So we have to have the help of a master to make these changes. We can't do it ourselves. And this can be done. A wonderful thing has happened in this century that hasn't been available to people before. And that is that the image of the face of the Master Jesus, and this works with the ashram of the Master Jesus, this temple is working under the direct force of what you might call the ashram of the Master Jesus, under the help and guidance of the Master Jesus, with other masters. We study with other masters. Other masters teach us. Other masters are with us. And other masters are just as great as the Master Jesus was. The Master Jesus is not to be confused with the Christ, who is the world teacher now, has succeeded from the Buddha. But let me continue. My doctorate is in New Testament studies, and most of us who are real scholars have a lot of look with a jaundiced eye upon a relic. When somebody says, here's a finger bone of St. Peter, well, we can find enough finger bones of St. Peter to stretch from here to San Jose, everybody had to have a relic of this and that in the early times. And when in the 1200s this relic appeared, It was called the Shroud of Turin. Most scholars didn't give it a lot of credence. They thought it was painted on or something like this. But it was when it was photographed 100 years ago, and the negative image turned out to be an absolute detailed photograph of the face of a man, and his body, his entire body, had been crucified. And unlike in all Christian tradition, not through palms of the hand, but through here, and in other great detailed examination of the shroud showed all kinds of details that simply could not have been faked or come up with by anyone who was falsifying things. For example, computer enhancement shows coins on the eyelids from the reign of Pontius Pilate. No one had even archaeologically discovered those coins yet, and they were there by computer enhancement, and many other kinds of things. And now just about any biblical scholar will tell you, based on there's tons and tons of internal evidence in this thing, that this is indeed the burial shroud of Jesus, and this is indeed the face of the Master Jesus. But the final confirmation was to be, and a lot of scientists have worked on this too, the final confirmation was to be radiocarbon dating of the shroud. When it was radiocarbon dated, it radiocarbon dated about 800 or 900 years later than that. And people said, well, we have to dismiss it. The material can't be that old. But as a matter of fact, they haven't considered the possibility, and I think it's a very real possibility, that whatever process it was that did not paint this on, but radiated this into the material, the process of the burst of radiant energy, whatever it was, probably, very likely, created a slightly higher percentage of carbon isotopes, radioactive isotopes.
A radio percentage of carbon.
Exactly. So that it would date younger.